Hi everybody, and welcome to the our podcast. That is our third episode. Yes, I think I'm right there, our third episode. So really excited about the comments and suggestions from last week. Samreen, we really enjoyed the conversation we had last week, I think, didn't we? It was quite thought-provoking.
It was brilliant. It really helped me reflect on, you know, mindfulness even amongst the staff.
Yeah, good. So we've really enjoyed listening to your thoughts and reading your thoughts and comments from our listeners. So thank you. Please keep those coming in. Really nice to hear from you all and to hear your stories, which are really powerful. So and really add to our learning. So thank you for that. Really delighted to welcome a guest. We've got another guest. We're doing well with our guests, 2 weeks running. Samreen, you introduced your guest last week. I'm going to introduce my guest, which is Karen Nash. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So that's a pleasure. Karen, you're the Nash Extension College Pastoral Officer. So really, do you want to just explain a little bit about your role?
Yeah, so I work with basically any student who's has some kind of additional challenges around learning, whether students have ADHD or autism or anxiety or just they just want to talk through some study skills to adapt to learning that might be in a slightly different way. So that's what I do. Students can have 3 sessions with me.
Right.
And that, usually students don't actually need 3 sessions. They might just have like 1 or 2 chats with me, and then they've got to get on with their courses. So.
Lovely. You've got the magic touch. So, Samreen, our topic today, because Karen's here, and it will make it become clearer why we've chosen this topic today, but it was something you thought of straight after the conversation we had last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was about ADHD in the classroom, and we were talking about how the diagnoses were sort of more awareness of it, people were talking about it, but actually how we supported young people who were struggling and how teachers did, and how often teachers felt quite disempowered because they didn't know how to. And we were talking about this, and you said, well, I know someone who might be able to help us for some really good reasons. And that's why we're here today with you, Karen. I'm really excited about this.
So Karen, you're much, as we all are, much more than our day jobs, but one of the reasons I've invited you along because you have some lived experience around ADHD. Are you comfortable just exploring that a little bit now?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I am actually I'm qualified as a teacher as well. So I think my experience probably speaks to one of the things that we're going to talk about today, in that I was late diagnosed with ADHD only 2 years ago when I was 53, which is very, very late. And I think when I first realised, people couldn't believe it, because I learned to read before I started school. I had a really high IQ, and I was at, you know, it was like towards the top of my classes until I got to secondary school. And things didn't dip straight away when I got to secondary school. But I ended up leaving school with 2 very bad A-levels. Well, not very bad A-levels. I got a D in general studies, which probably doesn't really count, an E in French, and I have 2 O grade Latins.
Linguist.
I don't know, because I'm very old. Yeah, well, I did. I took 3 languages at GCSE at O level.
Right.
So, yeah. So gradually, and I didn't do anything. You know, I had wanted to go to Cambridge and read English. I'd wanted to be a writer, and up until probably about halfway through secondary school, like probably about year 8 or 9 now, I thought that was what I'd be able to do. I read voraciously I was Matilda. I lived down the road from the library when I was a child, and I was allowed to go down to the library on my own. So, you know, I was actually Matilda. And I was reading classic fiction before I got to secondary school. So I was really smart and really loved reading. And I didn't even take English A-level because I'd just got to that point. And I think one of the things that I, when I was reflecting on this, I picked out, I don't know if you both know what rejection sensitive dysphoria is.
No.
For people who are listening, it's like an intense, really intense negative feelings and severe emotional pain caused by real or perceived rejection from people. And I'd had a really positive experience of English up until about halfway through year nine. And I can still remember now the name of the teacher, and I won't name that teacher, writing at the end of a story that I'd written something like, you don't need to write such long pieces of creative writing. And it really hurt because that was what I wanted to do. And I'd always been really supported. And then during my O-level GCSE years, I just didn't really gel with the teacher and didn't enjoy it anymore. And
I'm glad you've brought in that class, because I was going to ask, because this, you're, I'm sure, quite a sort of classic story in some respects, that you start off at primary age, very highly intelligent, student who's looking for all intents and purposes, their flight path is towards those A grades. And then something happens throughout one part of their schooling, and that could be a trigger of any sort that sort of triggers something that is just not enabling that child to move to that projected grade. Can you, apart from the teacher who sort of created that feeling within you, can you remember anything else teachers were doing or saying around how you were being?
I think I was, there was a kind of emphasis on the fact that I wasn't, I didn't put my hand up enough, that I wasn't contributing in class, that maybe I wasn't working to the level that they wanted me to. I wasn't kind of going deep enough into what they wanted me to be doing. I was kind of threatened with by my biology maths teacher to say that we don't think you're going to get your C's. And that actually gave me the kind of push that I needed to work a little bit harder, because the story that I was told was that I was really smart, and my parents kept saying, you know, you're really smart, you've got a really high IQ, etc. And I think partly I didn't know how did I have to study to get the grades that I was capable of. Whereas before, everything had just come so naturally to me. And there's that kind of step up, isn't there, when you're doing your exam courses.
I think what you're saying is so important, because that's a frustration I think I hear from other pupils as well, or other children in class, is that feeling that I'm not good enough and I'm not getting it right, because if everybody's telling me that I'm clever, and if everyone tells me that I was reading really quickly and I was doing all the things, why can't I do it right now? And that must feel really confusing, that must feel really disempowering as well. How did you find your way through that? Was it something you accepted about yourself?
Yeah, I think I threw myself into other things. I became obsessed by music. I took music CSE because I didn't have the ability to do the O-level. But I threw myself into that. And then during my A-levels, I realised that in those days we had polytechnics and universities. I could have probably gone to a polytechnic, but I didn't want to do that because I knew that I was capable of going to a university, which sounds very snobbish, but that's you know, that's what I felt. So I decided to, I think the kind of, I'm inattentive, so I have inattentive ADHD. But when you're going through that hormonal stage in your teens, there's this kind of drive to do things that are exciting. So I decided that I was going to train as a secretary and I was going to go and get a job in London and do something really exciting, which is what I did. But again, I found it really easy to learn shorthand, to learn all the letters, because it was another language for me. But I really struggled to actually use it because I struggle with my handwriting. So that wasn't really going to happen. And it wasn't really, it's only really over the last few years since I learned that I have ADHD that I've really started to consider it. I have been learning all my life. I went to university in my 30s. I did an English degree when I was about 33. I started that. And then I had to carry on studying afterwards.
But I think you say something so important there when you say that I actually really love learning. And you're definitely like one of these, a lifelong learner, as we talk about them. It sounds like you spent your whole life learning. And it reminds me of like a young person I was working with at school who was somebody who really loved learning, who used to really love reading, who really enjoyed writing, who loved doing all of those things. And yet she couldn't focus in class to the point where, and this is one of the reasons why actually I wanted to also talk about ADHD, because I work with young people who have learning difficulties. I feel like I'd get this, but she would say when she's looking at a piece of, like when she was reading, that the words would start moving around. So I thought, oh, she's got Erlen syndrome, which is a form of dyslexia where the words move around. And I was convinced about this. And I thought, oh, she's dyslexic. That's why she's finding it hard to process. That's why she's finding it hard to focus. Mm-hmm. And it was only much later that the doctors at work diagnosed her with ADHD. And it was only when she got the she needed medication, when she got the support, all those problems went away. She could read, she could write, she could do everything. And to this day, that sort of shocks me, that I thought I knew it. Like, how did I get that wrong? And I don't come from a place of not wanting to understand. Like, I was the one who was saying there's a problem and I got it wrong.
Yeah, that's really, I'm really curious about that actually, Sammy. So thank you for sharing that. I mean, just from a personal experience, I know somebody who was diagnosed in their 20s with ADHD. And there's a couple of areas that really align with what you were saying there. One is, I think you create something to fit something, don't you? It's like when you're on a walk, you're a little bit lost, and you look at the map and you think, well, there's a hill and there's a river, I must be here. Whereas actually you're not, you're miles away where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, but Esther, it's only because you only recognise a hill and you only recognise a river. Yes. You don't know anything else.
Exactly.
That's the language.
Absolutely. And that's that whole element around, well, how do we empower parents, teachers and the children themselves to recognise what it is that they're struggling with, to be able to articulate it in a way that teachers can understand, okay, this is where I feel you are, this is where I feel you may be, and therefore I can put this intervention in place or this strategy with you, and we can try that, see how that can work. Research really a long time ago, 2014, it's a long time ago, one child per classroom will have a diagnosis of ADHD. Now, unpicking all that, 2014, I'm sure a lot has changed since then, will have a diagnosis. So we know that it takes a long time for a child to have an assessment and have a formal diagnosis. But even just taking that as a figure, we can see obviously that there's going to be a lot of children who are slipping through what the teacher is delivering to a classroom of 30 in as differentiated as they can, but in a very limited way. So I'm curious around, obviously both being qualified teachers, how and I think we were talking before, Karen, you qualified quite recently, Sam Reen, you qualified a number of years ago. And I'm just curious about the initial teacher training and what there is currently to support teachers to recognise or help a child articulate what it is they're struggling with so they can try and define it, and whether there's more we could do around that initial teacher training process and CPD.
Well, I can be really quick because I didn't do it. I didn't cover it at all. I qualified in the year 2000 and I don't think we did anything around SEN. or any of, in fact, I remember teaching and they were talking about ADHD when I started teaching, but even then I felt far removed from any of that. So Karen, you qualified recently. Did you have a different experience to me?
I don't actually remember learning very much. So I qualified in 2017, and I'd already worked as a teaching assistant for 7 years, and I'd done an MBQ level 3 in supporting teaching and learning. So I kind of got a little bit of knowledge from that, but I don't remember really learning much about ADHD apart from the hyperactive boys. I don't think I was taught anything about ADHD in girls at all, because I think if I had, I probably would have started to pick things up for myself. But there was nothing.
It's fascinating because when I was just doing a little bit of research for this episode, there's a lot of data and a lot of studies out there. One in 2002 by Bussing, researchers demonstrate teachers' knowledge of ADHD significantly correlates with teachers' confidence in their ability to effectively teach children with ADHD and to create an inclusive classroom and manage behaviour. Now, that was in 2002. You're both talking about experiences that were past that. So I'm curious about what the barriers are to still embedding this into a teaching program that is really giving teachers the tools. Are we too busy? Is there too much for teachers to really get to grips with in that early, in that initial teacher training stage? Where do we place it so that it's really powerful for them?
We used to have some lectures every Friday morning because we were in schools 4 days a week, and then we had Fridays at university. And I think there needs to be voices of neurodivergent people going in and talking to students just for an hour on one of the sessions. I think that would make a huge difference, because then you're hearing a personal story and you're seeing the impact on people that not knowing how to pick up the signs, because it's not about having a diagnosis, it's actually about picking up the signs. And I, you know, looking back now, I can identify so many students who I think probably did have ADHD. And I feel really sad that I didn't know then.
Karen, I'd be really interested knowing, with your kind of experience of this and your experience of, you know, being in schools as a child and then being teaching and then being an adult, you know, being diagnosed recently, if you could go back to school and you could speak to your teachers, if there were just even 3 or 4 things that you would say this had to be done differently that would have helped, what would that be? Can you think of things?
I think the most important thing is kindness, compassion, empathy. Just trying to understand the student and know, and if you know a student is really enthusiastic about education, then try to have a conversation with them and try to help them to get to be the best they can, and not dismissing them. And maybe I never knew what questions to ask. I never knew what I found difficult. So, and again, maybe that's something that can be teased out by a teacher having it could just be a couple of minutes, and then that conversation, rather than everything just being inside my head, and inside my head was very jumbled and I didn't really know what was going on. And I thought, well, I'm supposed to be able to do this. That kind of thing might be helpful.
I find that really useful as a strategy, that sort of in-depth, you know, if a child's finding something difficult, then, you know, just exploring with them and maybe being able to separate out what those difficulties are. Because if somebody said to me, everything's jumbled in my head, then I'd instantly think, well, why is that? What's going on there? So that's a really useful kind of strategy, I think.
And building up that trust, I think, is the most important thing. Because if a student doesn't feel that they're safe, then everything's going to be even more jumbled up. They can be anxious. So
I think that's very powerful, and that element of trust. And I'm just conscious also of the pressures on teachers, and we know this, you know, teachers are obviously taking to the streets to really try and amplify how broken the system is at the moment and how it's not meeting the needs of every child. We can talk about inclusivity, we can talk about differentiation and all the pedagogical aspects that education and educators put forward, but the system has to be there to support that as well. So though the research says early referral is key, so the more knowledge teachers have, the better they'll identify if there is an issue with a child that needs some additional support, the earlier the intervention can put into place, and therefore the child has more opportunity to reach their potential. If we all accept that, then there's a disconnect then between the system being able to allow that to happen, I think, isn't there?
Absolutely. I agree with that.
I don't know what the answer is, but it's really, I mean, obviously there's a lot of work happening with teachers around continuing professional development, and that I think has really moved forward. There's a lot of resources and programs for teachers. There's additional funding, a small amount of additional funding for specialists within a school. But if you speak to any SENCO, they're saying, I'm not the one holding all this. It has to be every teacher holding this. Every teacher needs to look at their students and see the individual. But it's very hard to do that when you're delivering to a specification, a curriculum. And, you know, you've got to move everybody to a certain point without seeing where each individual child's journey is. And I think there's a lot of challenges ahead for that. Karen, just to finish, I wouldn't mind if you just... How do you feel your story would be if you were a child now? Do you feel it would be different?
I'm not sure it would, to be quite honest, because I still didn't fit that profile, because I was, you know, high attaining, and maybe my parents would have picked it up if now I was in the middle of secondary school, maybe my parents or teachers might start to look at it, and I would hope so, and I hope for, you know, anybody else, any other young me's that they can do that. And there just needs to be so much more, it needs to be so much more education and research. I'm actually doing a master's in psychology now, focusing on ADHD and autism, because I'm passionate about it, and I think it's really important that things change.
Well, it's wonderful that you are moving in that direction where you can start to, you know, increase your knowledge and skills around the subject and then to share with others. So that's wonderful. Well done, Karen. It's a really, you know, we've seen that sort of whole aspect from when you were a child, and I've almost see you in the classroom there, and that pain, obviously, that you went through at that point to who you are now, which is a really successful adult. Who's inquiring and learning and challenging yourself in the right way around your knowledge, skills, and how you're putting that forward in society and the amount of people you're helping now. So well done. Thank you. Are you happy to leave it there for today? This topic is so big. We could talk about it for a very long time.
Yeah.
I think we've come to some actions there that we feel would be a good way of concluding.
I agree. And I think if anyone listening has any questions or anything, we could always have Karen back and explore them further at some other point.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you. I agree. I think there's definitely a number of episodes. Yes. Thank you all. As always, sending your questions, as Samin said. Lovely. Thank you very much. Have a lovely evening.
Bye.